And welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert. And this week we are continuing on with our serial of Masters of Commander. This week is episode 5, and we are joined as always by Luke Truxell and Colin Colborne. Our beloved Dr. Sarah Myers has fallen out of formation today, so she will not be with us. But nevertheless, the mission continues on, and we have a sort. Oh my God, I am throwing so many crappy puns us already.
Not a formation was good, man. That was great.
I actually worked that up on the thing. I was like, don't forget to write that. For those of you know, we have a text thread going on, the four of us now, behind the scenes that blows up every so often. And then, of course, Sarah was like, there's too much going on. I have to drop out today. So, Sarah, we love you wherever you are. Hope you are getting an iPhone because the rest of us cannot go on with this green bubble nonsense. So, all right, guys.
It had to be said in public.
It does. Everyone should know this is no longer a secret. Sarah Myers has an Android.
Green text.
Oh, green text. Green bubbles. Oh, God. Green bubbles. Green bubbles are worse than flack. Did you say that
we're getting a lot of flack?
Ooh. Oh, see, yes. Very nice. And we have now lost the audience. So the three of us can just talk about this episode, episode 5. All right, guys. We're now like halfway through this series. The series is 9 episodes long. This is the episode 3. And kind of an interesting turning point in tone in this episode. We'll get into a spoiler-filled recap here in a little bit. But first, just our general spoiler-free impressions if people have not listened to it or watched this episode just yet. Where are we in the war? What's going on with the 100th Bomb Group? And post-Battle of Bremen here, is that what we say? Battle of Bremen? Bremen mission? How do we call this, Luke?
Well, Bremen gets bombed quite a lot in the war. So I would say we're in the kind of middle of Black Week, which is the bloodiest week. Well, I don't know if it's the bloodiest week because the 8th Air Force still takes heavy losses with the escort fighters in 1944 that we don't really talk about. But this is what we call the culmination point of the 1943 air offensive. This is the point where the 8th Air Force realizes they can't really go anymore. And we're in the middle of that week where they're learning that. They're suffering such high losses that by the end of the week, by the end of October, but October 14th is the last big mission, and they're going to take a pause between this mission on October 10th, which is the Munster raid, and then they'll try again on the 14th to hit the ball bearings. After that, the 8th Air Force has to do a full reassessment of what went wrong. And basically, so this is why it's called Black Week, because so many bombers are lost, and they reach the point where they can no longer continue operations without losing kind of the cohesion of the entire Air Force.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Air Force Museum's heading for this is Luftwaffe regains air superiority. If that gives you any idea of where we're at. And I actually wanted to, because last week, every week we sort of get so deep into things, especially 8th Air Force related. I also want to sort of talk about like where we're at in the war, in the whole war. And I think it's interesting because I think 1943 is one of those times that's not really well thought about. And, you know, it's easy also to sort of see where we're at with the 100th Bomb Group, where we're at with the 8th Air Force suffering horrific losses. But there's other stuff going on all around the world that is a little bit different. You know, we've already captured Sicily at this point in time. We've launched our invasion into Italy. And like last week, I was looking at newspaper articles about sort of what the American public is getting during Black Week. You know, like the American public, you know, newspapers don't say, you know, Black Week for the U.S. Air Force, right? Like what they're talking about is, you know, capturing Naples. You know, of course, we launched into Italy, but we have a long way to go before we ever capture Rome and keep going north of there even. In the Pacific, we have not yet launched our Battle of Tarawa, but we're building up a lot of the actions happening. We're sort of Guadalcanal is getting, is captured. We're moving the Central Pacific Force is moving up to the Gilbert's Islands, and the Southwest Pacific Force is moving in to sort of encircle and isolate Rabaul. And so things are all the pincer, if you will, of the Pacific is moving in. So we're making gains at a lot of places. Things are still very unsure, even in the Pacific at this time. And of course, on the Eastern Front, I want to just bring up real quick, the Germans are getting pushed, they're getting defeated, they're getting surrounded, and they are retreating. So, you know, it's so interesting to read Luftwaffe is, you know, regains air superiority when they're getting their butts kicked on the Eastern Front at this point in time and having to regroup. And so we're still sort of getting our you know, 8th Air Force legs under us and moving forward. So I hope that helps sort of put context into the greater war here.
And to kind of follow up on Colin's point, the air war is also changing for the Americans very rapidly in the fall, because some of those changes they realized they had to make after the summer operations are already taking place. We're already seeing, for instance, one of the reasons why we see P-47 escorts a little bit further this time, we're starting to see them come onto film. They can't really go as far, but they can finally get into a little bit of Germany with these new larger drop tanks. And so we see them in this episode, partially because they have the extended fuel tanks that they need, the larger ones. But also what's happening is long-range escort fighters are now arriving in England. There's a P-38 group that has arrived that is basically kind of coming together. There's a huge debate during this week about whether to deploy them basically this week. But they're not – basically the assessment is they're not ready yet. They still need to get all their forces. They need to get the logistics. But they really almost did deploy P-38s really ad hoc. And they only had one group. And they were going to just kind of – the idea was we'll just send them out in front of the bombers and clear the way. But they just weren't ready in time for this week. And so that is another thing. So the air war is shifting as well, because we're starting to see the long-range fighters and the capabilities of a long-range escort fighter increase for the Americans during this period. But it's just not there yet. And so – it's not there in time for it to participate in these missions. And so big picture, a lot's changing against the Germans, but not in time to turn around the 1943 air offensive. And this is really where everything just falls apart for the Americans.
Yeah, guys, I want to ask you, you know, kind of getting to these bigger points here. You know, the Americans are pushing now. We're starting to see these fighters really coming for the first time, even though they have to kind of drop out. And I kind of want to get into some of the signaling that this show has done a really good job with as we become more familiar with what air combat looks like. But is there a sense, gentlemen, amongst like American high command that this war is going to be won at some point? Like, is the contingency like we could still lose this war, or is it at this point in time we know we are going to win this war? It is just going to be a bloody push until the very end. What's the general viewpoint of like American brass in say fall of 1943?
I mean, I will at least say, and I know Luke's got some great stuff, especially on the Air Force side. I will say that when we talk about the amount of stuff that the United States is producing at this point in time, you know, we often sort of think about 1944 as being basically when the war sort of turns in many ways. And that's because of the stuff that's being built right now. And you can see it in the planning. And of course, I have a lot more sort of experience, you know, on sort of Pacific planning side, but you can see when that what they're planning for is a lot of momentum. You know, they're not sort of being as cautious as they had been earlier in 1943. And, you know, the Japanese Navy is not defeated yet. And these are a whole bunch of things that aren't to do with 8th Air Force. But I think that commanders, at least in the Pacific, are seeing a lot of momentum. And I think you're seeing that in Italy as well. I mean, once we hit some of these real bad defensive lines, that's going to slow down a bit. But, yeah, I don't think that there's dire straits anymore at this point, in my opinion. I think we're seeing a lot of like, this is moving forward. I don't think you could say we're going to win the war at this, you know, yet, but you can see that the United States is like, we're about to outstuff everyone.
I think there's two ways to really look at this. There's the grand strategic picture, which is kind of the overall nature of the war and the trend of the war. And I think the Allies do have a sense that things are moving in the right direction and that they're going to improve in 44. But there's also this concern that they could also, if they don't get their act together in certain areas, that it could also reverse again in some way, like something may not work out. So again, the tide is definitely turning, but they also realize that they got to make the necessary changes to make sure that they can continue that momentum and continue to improve in 44. That's the big strategic picture, especially in the European theater. The way I describe it for Germany is there's a lot of holes popping up in a dam and they're putting fingers in them. But in 44, what's going to be crazy is it's all going to collapse starting really in the spring. Spring of 44, we're going to start to see some holes actually bust loose in that dam on the Eastern Front, particularly in Ukraine. But then in the summer of 44, the whole thing's just going to collapse. And that's when we see, you know, all these big gains in 44 on the ground and in the air war. But in the other thing to look at, that's the big picture. The other thing to look at is operations, which is kind of campaigns. And that's where they're less certain about. It's going to take the brass a while to realize that they lost the air war in 43. In fact, they're pretty confident they're winning it after this week. There's lots of takes from the RAF, from the Americans. Everybody is pretty like, hey, we got bloodied, but due to the fighter claims, due to the what we can see on the bombing results, they took it worse. And so obviously the Luftwaffe was about to collapse. And in fact, some of the positive takes are that Lewis Brereton, the commander of the 9th Air Force that's being built up in England at this time, in fact, is at a meeting where I think the commander of the 8th Air Force, Ira Aker, says something along the lines, we also need to start building contingency plans for the collapse of Germany in 1944, to which he was kind of like, I think it's a bit too soon to do that based on, I don't think we have the full results of this air war. In November, the mood changes when they realize that that didn't happen and that the situation has not changed. And so there's a panic in November of 44 and 43. There's a panic in November of 43 when they realize the war, the air war, is still stuck where it was when they started this whole thing. And so they're starting to debate, should we push back Overlord, you know, the landings in Normandy? Should we push back all these land operations? Because the whole idea was, is by this point in the air war, we will have gained air superiority. So they had planned to gain air superiority by October and November of 43. When they realized by November of 43 that these bombing raids in the fall, particularly the ones in October, did not yield anywhere near the results that they had hoped for, then basically there's this panic. And that's when you start to see them continue to push change. They start to really get their act together. And you see all kinds of different changes taking place with logistics, with escort fighters, with command changes, reorganization. And they have to get them all right because they have to gain air superiority the way the plan is written before they start the pre-bombardment phase of Overlord, which is the to shape the battlefield with the strategic bombers. And they basically gain a pretty good leg up on air superiority to the point that they can start implementing that pre-Overlord bombardment plan by April of 44. So, yeah, this is where they realize they lose. So operationally, they're really worried.
Yeah.
But strategically, at the big picture, they're mostly positive. So again, it's kind of a weird kind of mindset to see these commanders in.
All right, I want to jump now into the episode. We're going to continue on now. We're going to spoil the episode. So if you haven't had a chance to see the episode, by all means do, because I've been really happy with the quality of these episodes. It's really become appointment viewing for me. I know the episodes drop technically on Friday, but it seems like they're hitting on Thursday nights now. And I'm just like, okay, it's go time. So I watched this Friday. I typically tend to watch these on Saturdays, but I watched these on Friday, and it's still very much in my mind. And I'm just going to hit you guys with some basic ideas as we're coming out. Seems to be an overwhelming thought coming out of that Bremen raid is still the idea of loss, the idea of loss of Buck. Bucky is clearly combating this with alcohol. I think that this is probably not to be expected. What's Bucky going through here? What's our thoughts here as these guys are earning this title, this bloody 100th group? How are these guys dealing with the loss here? And the idea, not only the loss, but the idea that they're next, right? If Buck can go down, you know, the idea that Cleveland can go down, who's next here?
I'll go ahead and go. You know, there's this kind of, it's almost like acceptance that they're just as that their number might come up or eventually will come up at this point. Because again, there's certain people, and we mentioned this in the last episode, but again, to reemphasize, Cleven is kind of that stable force within the group at this time. He's kind of that guy that, you know, is that, you know, every units have certain leaders and people in them who are veterans, who've seen combat, who everybody kind of rallies around. And it's like, this is our kind of stabilizing force that we can kind of, no matter how bad things are, we can kind of bond with this, or this guy, guy is there for us. Losing Clevin really shook the group up quite a bit. The good news is that we find out at the beginning of the episode that Crosby's still alive and that Blakely's still alive. And in fact, now they kind of accelerate things with Crosby's timeline. They condense some things. He doesn't get his promotion quite yet. What the reason he's not on the Munster raid is because actually because of how messed up their plane was and how messed up they were after the raid, they basically said, here's a spare B-17. Go do a supply run and bring some supplies back to the base. That's why they're not there. Basically, Jack, the good news is Jack Kidd's still there. Jack Kidd was on Crosby's plane. He was the operations officer. And so he becomes kind of that stabilizing force for the group. But a lot of these guys are pretty messed up after Clevin goes down. That was a huge morale shock to the group. And the mood really kind of turns south. There's concerns about the group commander. With LeMay even has concerns about the group commander. So there's a lot of concerns about the 100th, not just within the group itself, but also from the higher ups, that they're seeing that the morale is a real problem. And they got that they're trying to figure out whether they need to shake some things up. The other problem is with cohesion. I've seen this comment now a few times to where I think we could probably address it, is that some people are complaining online that there's not really a lot of connection to the characters, that it's like, well, they're kind of, they come and they go and they come and they go. It's like, well, yeah, that's kind of the point that the writers are trying to make, is that, you know, with a 37% attrition rate, they come and they go. You can't connect with them. There's a reason why, you know, you come in with a certain group of guys, when they're gone, and it's just you. And you kind of, the group of guys you came with, when they're gone and you're the only one left, well, and so there is a element of disconnect with these guys as they kind of come in, go MIA, KIA, or they get so wounded they got sent back. And in fact, only one of the 35 original crews of the 100th Bomb Group actually complete their 25th mission. And that's the one we saw in the, not this episode, but the previous one, Glenn Dye's crew. And that's the thing I had to kind of hold back because I knew Jason would get mad at me if I spoiled that before the next episode. But yeah, his crew is the only one to complete it. And in fact, right after the Munster raid, they're actually wondering, should we recall them? Should we call them back so we can put another plane in the air? So yeah, that's how bad things are.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because also like a lot of these guys, and we talked a little bit about this last week, a lot of these guys fly together, but oftentimes one or two will get put on a, you know, navigator needed here, you know, gunner needed here. And so while oftentimes you'll see, you know, a crew, you know, the so-and-so crew, eventually what those guys not die, you know, maybe not dying off, but they're going missing over Germany one at a time, to the point where, yeah, you're flying with guys who are all replacements or all just sort of amalgamations. And, you know, you don't have easy company, you know, going through the entire war together. And, you know, that's so, you know, and it's very similar in the Pacific as well. So it's, it there isn't the group cohesion that you may see all the time. And, you know, even when I was trying to sort of research my great uncle and, you know, he was a pilot when he went down, there's no photo of the Howell crew. You know, his last name was Howell. You know, he was a co-pilot with a different crew. And then when, you know, when another plane needed a lead pilot, he stepped in there and, was with an amalgamation of guys. And so just, that's going to bring morale down, of course. And we see that scene where they come back to their bunks and the replacements are there and they're like, no, we're still here. You know, get out of here and stuff. And, that's going to keep, tearing people down, I think, actively.
And I interviewed a veteran once, to kind of pick up on this point, that he was a ground crew that eventually became an air crew because they converted him because they needed extra, machine gunners. And the air crew that he was with completed their 25th mission before he did. And so they get sent home. So he gets put on another crew. But when he's about to complete his 25th mission, it's with a crew that's like one of the younger crews. And their plane's pretty shot up and they're thinking about bailing out over the channel or something like that. He basically got on the intercom. It's like, no, we're not bailing out. We're going to crash land this thing in England. We're going to take the risk because I am so not going to take my chances in the channel on my 25th mission. So they crash land at like some airfield. And in fact, they thought he was dead on his 25th mission for a little bit. And basically he got home once they got him to the airfield, you know, he you know, some of the local British soldier, a British civilian, helped him contact his family to let him know. And usually there's a big celebration when you get your 25th. They paint 25 on you. They do all kinds of stuff. But yeah, I mean, there is that kind of like guys completing their 25th at different times, and also combat losses affecting all this as well. So cohesion is a real problem with not just the group, but also with air crews.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one quick question here, which is, you mentioned Crosby's on this supply run. Do supply runs count as missions?
No, they were just flying like somewhere in England to like pick up some, I can't remember what it exactly was, but he also mentioned something about they realized they had some time to go visit Stonehenge. So they went and flew over and visited Stonehenge while they were. So again, this was kind of a way to get these guys off a mission, yet still doing something for the group, get them some rest because they were kind of beat up and worn out. And they arrived very late the night before that mission. So that's kind of why. I mean, he does get promoted. He does describe all that stuff about getting promoted, but they did condense a lot of Crosby's story in this episode, also including with what happened with Bubbles, because Bubbles, I guess I'll spoil it. Bubbles does not die on this raid. He dies in 44. In fact, that raid was really bad because the new group commander of the 100th actually took a direct hit. Bubbles was on that plane and it exploded. So you not only lost your best navigator outside of Crosby for the group, but you also lost the group commander in a raid in 44 with the 100th. So, I mean, just because the escort fighters arrived doesn't mean it gets any better for a lot of these air crews, you know, because the attrition rates are still pretty high as they try to win the air war. It's not till we see really the summer of 44 that the attrition rates start to drop back down again.
When guys are near like their 25th mission, when they're at like 22, 23 or whatever, did command ever give them easier bombing raids to ensure that did they get sent to bomb Kmart or something like that? I mean, what was, or were they still being sent into the shit all the way up to their 25th?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You weren't getting time off when you got close.
No. Okay. They're not. Basically, everything stays the same. And again, you know, we go back to what we discussed on like the first or second episode we did of this with Max Effort Missions, you know, that they don't care, you know, about how close you are to your 25th, you know.
These are experienced pilots.
Yeah.
Need the experience. You need these guys. It's like taking your, you know, salty sergeant and saying, you've been here long enough. We don't need you anymore. You need those guys.
Yeah. You need them for the war effort, and if we lose them on the 24th or 25th mission, that's the nature of war, I guess.
And it does happen. It does happen. Guys do go down on their last two or three missions. Not uncommon to see a guy lose it on his 25th.
There's another thing that happens, I think, that they really illustrate as far as attrition goes in this episode, which is that it doesn't take losing a plane to lose these guys. You know, a lot of these guys are going to come back. The planes are shot up through flak, through Luftwaffe attacks, things like that. So you've got 10 guys on a fort, and they come back, and there's 8 guys remaining or whatnot. So you're, you know, and these guys are having to watch their friends die often horrifically. I mean, we see this as well, right?
Yeah, and Crosby mentions again, I know why they didn't show it, because there's only so much air combat you can show, but Saunders' death was actually pretty bad to read about in Crosby's book, because he basically bled out while they were trying to make it home. Ugh. And he was bleeding out in the plane as they were taking him out of the ambulance, but by the time they got him out, so again, some of these guys are bleeding out and dying in the plane as they're trying to get back home, and they're trying to save them unsuccessfully. So it's not like you can get them to a medic right away. You can't get them medical treatment right away. You got what's left in the plane. So it's awful when you get wounded up there, because there is no first aid. There is no person, you know, and that's the thing that Memphis Belle doesn't really do a good job of. The film Memphis Belle kind of indicates that there's a medic on board. No, there's not, you know? So.
Yeah. Your buddy with the tourniquet's probably the best you got.
Yeah.
So I guess the number of the day is 17 when we look at this particular episode. I think they sent 17 forts up in this particular mission. Is that correct?
17 takeoff, 4 abort.
Right.
17 takeoff, 4 abort. This is a horrific exercise. It seems to be, everyone seems to understand on the ground that this is not going to work well. But as they're taking off, there's a real sense of foreboding this entire episode as we get into the battle. Am I correct?
There is. And I think this is, you know, Luke and Sarah and I spoke about sort of how they may treat some of the raid, the monster raid. And I think they did it by this sense of foreboding and this idea, you know, it's not only that they have to go the next day, it's that it's also a Sunday. And they're bombing the city center, right? So we're sort of combining not only the foreboding of a tough mission, but also the idea that we're really kind of throwing some bombs at civilians here on Sunday, walking out of church, so to speak.
Yeah, they kind of danced around it a little bit. They said the aiming point was the marshalling yards. It's actually the cathedral itself. So that was the aiming point. And so, I mean, they handled it very well, you know, even though they got some very tiny details like rivet counting slightly off, you know, for the most part, they handled the scene well in the buildup, talking about how we're going to go attack civilians. Because this is, Harris came up with, RAF Air Marshal Harris came up with this idea of dehousing German workers in addition to hitting targets and killing civilians, which is, well, you disrupt their lives, you destroy their homes, they're not going to be as effective workers, or you're going to kill the workers as well. And so we do see area bombing for the first time. And yes, the Americans were very divided over it, not just at the aircrew level, as is, and that whole conversation did happen. Egan was ready to go kill as many German civilians as possible right before this raid after Cleven died. He is pretty much unhinged. The way they portrayed him, pretty fairly accurate. I don't know about the drinking, but that's pretty much how he went into that raid, which is he's in there to kill Germans. And a lot of the air crews were like, this is not what we do. This is not our doctrine. This is not how we're trained. This is goes against everything we've been told. And this is goes against, for a lot of them, their morality, which is we're going to go kill civilians now. And there's a lot of 8th Air Force brass that are divided over this issue. Arnold wants results. Aker doesn't want to do it, but he feels compelled to do it because Arnold's breathing down his neck, threatening to make some big changes if he doesn't start showing results in the air war. So you start to see that departure from precision bombing to area bombing and attacking civilians on purpose now. And so I like that they showed that division in there and that tension going into this raid and the tension going into the raid with regards to not having enough aircraft to start with in the first place.
All right. I want to compliment the show for a second here because I had this realization as we were watching as the forts are all trying to get in formation on this bombing raid, and I'm realizing I'm watching Egan's fort. I'm like, oh, they're way too far away, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, they're in a hole here. And I think it was a really cool thing that they've done as far as educating the viewers here, because even I, who have no experience, you know, with these bombing things, I'm like, oh, they're in trouble here. Just immediately seeing this, and it was kind of this interesting thing. I realized, oh, this show has been teaching me about how battles operate, because I'm like, well, they're way too far back, and they're not going to catch those other guys. We got issues here.
I mean, timing and spacing. I totally agree that they've done a good job with that, and it happens, of course, at the end of the episode. With the sole remaining fortress that's left, and they see the group way up ahead, and they're like, it's just us.
Yeah, yeah.
And that actually became a big issue on this mission, not just like in terms of how they portrayed it, but I think it's fair to say Egan deserves some criticism for the separation.
All right. Thus far in the show, we've really had two main characters. We've had Buck and Bucky, Cleven and Egan, and as I was texting you guys this as I was watching the show, going, oh shit, this just became the Rosenthal show. Can we talk about this new guy, this new guy who as I read ahead, I'm like, oh, okay. Because we're texting as we're watching this. I'm like, wait a second. Can you dogfight with a B-17? Cause it's sure felt like that's what Rosenthal was doing. Is like, I'm going to line this plane up so you guys can get shots on this thing. It felt like he was piloting this aircraft, like you might pilot, you might steer a frigate or something like that to give him broadside shots on these incoming Luftwaffe. I was all in. I was like, man crush engage on Rosenthal. Can we talk about who this guy Rosenthal is without spoiling too much about what happens with him in the future? And why he becomes so important to the narrative of Masters of the Air and this bomb group in particular.
Let you take that, Luke.
It's the Germans. it's actually Dr. Myers chiming in. She's like, "Oh yeah, like I'm not going to Apple." So it's Sarah out there somewhere.
Google, more Google.
Go ahead and say it. Rosenthal survives the war, right? Because he becomes very important in Nuremberg. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to talk real quick too about the interrogation. And
please,
from my perspective, it's so interesting seeing the sort of dramatization of the interrogation, because, you know, our my job with Project Recover is to find cases of these aircraft. When I say a case, usually that means an aircraft that crashed during World War II, and, you know, that has historical information that we can go off of in order to search for it underwater. And what we have 95% of the time is what they came up with in these interrogations after each you know raid, so to speak. And we're basing a lot of our knowledge and planning everything where to go based on what they come up with after these raids. And it's so interesting because there are, of course, levels of accuracy, especially when it comes to these things. And you can see, we saw it in the last episode, we see it a lot in this episode, where these guys are I saw a couple shoots come out. You know, of course, they were wrong when they were talking about the one guy that came back. I don't remember who was it, Blakely that came back. They said they saw shoots, and they're like, no, they didn't. What this gets translated into is called a missing air crew report, which we call MACRS. And these are sort of the primary research method that along with some other records that my group has in order to go and find these airplanes. And they sit down and they talk to these guys, and you can see in the missing air crew report, you can see, paragraph from this guy who saw it, paragraph from this, the left waist gunner saw it, the ball turret gunner saw it. And, you know, when we are sort of looking at these things, we're also prioritizing. We're saying, okay, they were 30 miles out to sea. You know, how accurate is this X that they put on the map going to be when you're 30 miles out to sea? You know, whereas it's like they crash right off of this point here, you know, they saw land and sort of the prioritization of that. And so, and I'm getting a little off topic here, but for me, this was such a fascinating part of watching Masters of the Air in this last episode and the episodes before it, to watch the dramatization of the interrogation room. Cause again, this is what I am looking at. These are my, as a historian, these are the records that I'm interrogating in order to figure out where these guys went. And it's amazing to think how much we today rely on these things. And, you know, you forget sometimes, I mean, we know that it's there, but you forget the stress that these guys are under during these missions. And they are having to sort of come back and say, yeah, you know, 270173, sure, that one blew up and hit another one. And I've always wondered, you know, as I'm reading these things, like, how do you look back and know that that's so-and-so's, you know, B-17, and that's this guy's B-17, yeah. And like, especially in these huge formations, I mean, it's really baffling. So anyway, that's my sort of, I found that really interesting just in terms of watching how that happens.
Yeah, Colin, you know, it's interesting because for and I had the same thing, like, how do you know, like, oh, that's Tom's fort or that's Bob's fort or whatever. And of course, you know, they've all got maybe some painting and some decoration on the nose of the plane or whatever. But we saw in this case, a lot of these guys are having to move around to different forts. You know, they're taking over new, like, oh, wait, I'm on this plane now. This is my plane. You know, I don't know this name, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, you're doing this the whole time while you're being attacked by the FLAC, Luftwaffe, or you're just trying to survive getting back. You're taking – I don't know how these guys do it. Here's a question I've got for you, though. We see in the interrogation, there's some real anger on the part of these crewmen towards their senior officers. Does that come across in the archive at all when you look at this kind of stuff? Or is it very kind of plain, kind of written, whatever?
I mean, obviously, what you see mostly is statement of fact. But there are some hints sometimes. And sometimes what you come across are disagreements with what happened. You know, like so-and-so says they saw 8 parachutes. I saw that ship blow up and saw nothing. And you'll have, and then of course we are left as the, you know, 80 years down the line, often with no one to talk to anymore who was on those raids, reading these and sort of saying, well, do we believe the 2 parachutes? Do we believe that this is the airplane that crashed at this place? Or do we believe it blew up? And a lot of times what's the best part of what I do is we can scan the ocean floor and we can reveal the answers to those questions. And we can sort of say, this is what happened. Here's this fort, you know, this fortress is here. This B-24 is here, you know, and, you know, if we're lucky, and many times we're not lucky, but if we're lucky, we can identify those, every one of those 50 cal machine guns that you saw going off in that show, has a serial number on it, a serial number that has in many cases lasted over the decades. And you can still find today, underwater. And so we can, and it's included in that missing aircrew report. You can see all the serial numbers of the engines and the machine guns in many of them. And so we can put those pieces together. And so that I think is really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, there, you can definitely see disagreements. In fact, I see that happen.
Colin, I want to deviate from this for just a second, because I want to ask you actually about Project Recover in these situations where you're able to, say, identify a downed bomber, whether it's B-17, 29, whatever that is. Are there ever attempts when you've identified a plane and it's 30 feet down, 50, 100 feet, I don't know how deep these are. I'm sure they're plenty deeper, to recover portions of those planes at all, or is it best to, like, leave them at rest as the idea of maybe of two? What's the ethics behind when we find a plane, when you find a plane, you identify it, we know exactly what fort this was. What's the ethics behind how you approach that ship now?
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, this is a gravesite. This is a tomb. This is a hallowed ground, so to speak. So for us, at least, they are treated as such. And this is an archaeological site, just like if you had found, you know, some major archaeological site in the Middle East or somewhere. Don't touch anything. Whenever we do our research, whenever we initially find these wrecks, we photograph them, document them, and, you know, they become crime scenes. And when we do the recovery process, oftentimes what that takes is us cutting these planes or cutting into these planes. Oftentimes it means dredging huge areas around the planes in order to find remains. And it's a destructive process to the aircraft. And at the end of it, the aircraft is put back, you know, on the bottom and left where it lies. And so nothing is ever taken that, you know, especially not for, it is from the crime scene perspective, because if we find material evidence, if we find someone's ID, rings, watches, things that could be identifying to a person, we will, you know, those will be taken as part of the chain of evidence in order to identify this crew and identify this airplane. But in terms of bringing them up for like restoration and stuff, which there is a large market for that stuff. There are very rare aircraft out there, stuff that we've found. Interestingly, in two different places in the Pacific, we found two Japanese aircraft that of which six were made total, and just happened to be in our search areas for two of our things. And those would be very, very, very valuable. And so it's our job as Project Recover to try to get these guys back home to their families. The aircraft is really secondary to it. And, you know, we do not publicize the locations of these aircraft. They are not tourist sites to go visit again. This is something that's very sacred to us. So, that's the ethics from our point of view. And that's exactly why we, especially in places where lots of scuba divers are, where there's lots of people looking for this stuff, we often have to keep, you know, tight-lipped about where we're at and what we're doing.
Yeah, I definitely had wondered about how that works as far as getting these remains or personal belongings back to families, back to descendants or closest kin and things like that, and how difficult that must be. But especially 70, 80 years removed now from these battles, you work beyond the scope of Sage Rose World War II, am I correct? Right.
We've found a B-52 off the coast of Vietnam, from Vietnam. We've found several other planes from Vietnam. And we have located, we've been in a search for a plane as recently as a Gulf War aircraft that went missing. So it's not just World War II. It's, you know, really World War II and forward. Obviously, the planes that they had in World War I, there's not much left of those if they went missing in the first place. But
paper.
Yeah. But if you look at the numbers, and this is what I've always said, if you look at the numbers, there are 82,000-ish missing in action from our conflicts, World War II and forward. 72,000 of those are from World War II. So on pure numbers alone, World War II is our primary sort of search capability. And it's taken us all over the world, Africa, you know, Europe, and in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and the Middle East even. So wherever World War II was fought and aircraft were lost, we'll go looking.
All right. We've now made it halfway through the series. We've made it halfway, I guess, as Luke was saying earlier, through Black Week. We've seen some previews as far as what to expect. I kind of live for these previews for next week because I'm kind of living Friday to Friday
They're like really right? Like mini trailers too. I mean, with Egan coming out of the swamp at the end. I was like, whoa.
Oh, and right. He's hiding, and you've got the German guys. Like, I mean, I was like, oh shit, what's going on here? Like, you know, what are we looking for to as far as coming in through the next week?
Yeah, I think we're going to start seeing a lot about the guys who didn't make it in the air and ended up on the ground. It looks like we're going to start diving into the experience of these guys who are going to be taken prisoner or trying to evade being taken prisoner. And then it looks like also we're going to dig deeper into the trauma issue, I think. which is always good. And it's something that they've focused on in every single one of these series that Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg have done. They have focused in on the trauma that these guys go through. I think there are other good ones, but the Bastogne, of course, episodes for Band of Brothers and the way these guys are just losing it, rightly so. I think that's what we're going to be looking for in the next episode. And I'm curious. I mean, you know, you've seen little teasers of Red Tails, and you've seen some of these other things. We know we're going to be diving into these prison camps. We're going to find out who survived, you know, these things. And one interesting thing from my perspective, I did a lookup of sort of 100th Bomb Group missing in action. So not just killed in action, but missing in action.
Right.
And there's barely any from these 2 days, these raids in October. You know, these aircraft went down in pretty populated areas, and in many cases, either the guys survived or those bombers were found by the American Graves Registration Service after the war. And so they've been accounted for, which I always found very interesting.
Yeah, there's so much. There continues to be so much more to look forward to. I think I'm looking forward to seeing, I guess, more fighters, fighter escort, perhaps. I didn't know that Tuskegee Airmen had an affiliation with this bomber group, but I'm assuming from the commercials that we've seen with this.
I didn't think they did either. I thought they were just in the 15th Air Force, maybe some others. So, you know, Luke may have more ideas on that, but I didn't think so. So at some point, we're going to transition over to them or just sort of talk about them in some context. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing another interpretation on film of, you know, you mentioned Red Tails a little bit earlier, and of course the HBO series years ago, the Tuskegee Airmen with Lawrence Fishburne. I'm looking forward to hopefully telling some of those stories as well on this. Nothing but drama going forward. I got the anxiety of this show, man. Like, you make it out, bailing out over Russell's and bailing out over, say, Germany versus bailing out over Belgium are two radically different scenarios. Absolutely.
Absolutely true. By the way, those Eastman jackets, I want one.
Absolutely. I'm in. So, all right. Looks like Luke managed to join the formation just as this sortie is coming to a close. Luke, do you have any closing thoughts on this particular episode?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good episode in showing basically loss and basically in the sense of showing kind of that culmination point, not just like loss in terms of the crews losing people they loved and all that stuff, but also showing kind of the end of this offensive and what defeat looks like. Because again, that was always my big concern, is that this is going to be something new that these writers and creators had done. And by the end of the episode, it's made very clear to the viewers that we have lost this offensive, that this is the end. And this, they need to stop, they need to regroup, and they need to rethink. Now, this is not going to be nearly as bad as the next raid that they're going to be on, which is the second Schweinfurt raid, which is going to lose 60 bombers. And in fact, the 100th Bomb Group puts up 5 more that they cobble together for that raid. That's one of the few missions during this period that they don't lose any bombers. And in fact, they have to condense the 95th and the 100th for that raid. So again, it shows kind of how these groups are basically being shot up so badly that basically, you know, this offensive has to come to an end. It shows the effects on the men, the ground crews, the officers, even the planes themselves, you know. And I thought the music in the episode was very good at basically illustrating that. So yeah, I thought this was a really good episode, and it ties very well into that theme of loss that was built into episode 4 that kind of helped us get ready for this big moment. So I thought they did a really good job setting the stage for this and then executing this. This is the big point that we were building to all the way from episode 1, this one. And so, as Colin mentioned earlier, I'm curious to see how they branch out and they go forward now that we've reached kind of this big moment where the air offensive in 43 came to an end.
All right. Well, that leads us where we're at now. Luke Truxell, Colin Colburn, we'll see you guys next week.
Love it.
Yep.
Love it.
All right, dudes.
All right, thanks.